and, you know, for the earth. And so that's my campaign, is to get that, to empower the Indigenous voice and to have people understand that there's a different way of thinking.
Great. Thank you so much.
Okay, we got to run. Thank you so much to all of you, and thanks for co-hosting, Jackie.
Sure.
It's Paul Rowland with Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Real Cool Film Series at the Clinton Street Theater. This month we'll show the film Body and Soul, An American Bridge, on Thursday, June 15th at 7 p.m. The 1930s tune, Body and Soul, composed by Jewish songwriter Johnny Green, it was first recorded as a jazz piece by Louis Armstrong. Filmmaker Robert Phillipson goes in-depth to examine the song's timelessness and its role at the heart of both Black and Jewish music. Again, that's Body and Soul, Thursday, June 15th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
What lies before me? Future's calling me. Winter that's gray and old.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Pedalpalooza Become the Media Outreach Ride, Sunday, June 18th, from 2 to 4 p.m., starting at Holiday Park in Portland. This Pedalpalooza ride visits the independent media sites of Portland, including KBOO, Freeform, the IPRC, Open Signal, and more. On this ride, you'll learn about how to become part of the independent media movement and explore the opportunities to join our media outlets together. Again, that's Become the Media Outreach Ride, Sunday, June 18th, from 2 to 4 p.m., starting at Holiday Park at Northeast 11th and Holiday Streets in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning, it's 9:01. You're listening to KBOO Portland. And here's what we have coming up for you this morning on KBOO. First, on Intersections Radio, Jennifer Yu, the author of 4 Weeks, 5 People, talks about mental health stigma in Asian American communities and the exorbitant cost of treatment. At 9:30, Between the Lines Radio says that Trump's rationale for pulling out of the Paris Accord was based on lies. The feds are moving to impose harsher sentences in drug cases, and California is taking the first steps towards single-payer universal health care. At 10 o'clock, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, and at 11 o'clock, The Dirtbag will answer your questions about your gardening woes. And we thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a member, you can easily become one when you go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. Thanks for doing that. And now we're going to go to Intersections Radio.
You're listening to Intersections Radio, the podcast where we geek out on all things intersectionality. I'm your host, Sarika Mehta. Welcome, and thanks for tuning in. Now, I've been wanting to do more episodes on the complex issues of mental health, especially as they play out in our Asian American communities. Specifically, they don't. And really, on the one hand, it's considered weak and humiliating to air such quote or unquote dirty laundry. And on the other hand, I wonder if even, you know, at this basic level, our languages have words to describe the issues that our people face, much less the ability to explain some of these concepts across our intersectional lives. So I am thrilled to chat with author Jennifer Yu about her debut novel, 4 Weeks, 5 People. This novel follows 5 teenagers who attend a camp in the woods in upstate New York over the course of 4 weeks of group therapy. And there's some very unique characters in the story, including an Asian American girl with obsessive compulsive disorder who finds safety in numbers. And there's also a boy who struggles with anorexia and another boy with narcissistic disorder. The novel follows their experiences from each of their points of view and as they relate to each other. And Jennifer Yu wrote this novel as a way to come out and cope with her own experiences with depression and anxiety. She joins me today by phone from Boston. This is Intersections Radio. Jennifer Yu, thank you so much for joining me on Intersections Radio.
No, thank you so much for having me.
Tell us a little bit about yourself first for our listeners.
Sure. Sure. So I am 21 and I live in Boston, and I graduated last May from the University of Pennsylvania. I majored in creative writing. And I've sort of spent, you know, my entire life writing, but recently I was super obviously over the moon to have my first novel published. So it's called 4 Weeks, 5 People. It came out a couple of months ago and it's like on shelf now. So this is obviously, the entire process has just been a dream come true.
Yeah, congratulations to you for this debut novel coming out and all of the press that you've received. And as you were mentioning about college, one of the interesting facts that I learned about you is that when you were in college, you really tried to avoid majoring in creative writing.
Yeah, so when I started university, I was pre-med, which is, I'm sure, as many of our Asian American listeners will understand, is sort of the par for the course for many teenagers coming from Asian American households, is there's this sort of expectation that you're going to be like a doctor, and if not a doctor, a lawyer, and if not a lawyer, an engineer. Mm-hmm. And so writer is definitely not on the short list of desirable professions. So there was definitely a sense, like, as I was going through university, of like, okay, like, I know I love to write, and I know I love to read, and I know I love, like, English as a subject, and I always have, but that's something that's just not feasible as, like, you know, something you do professionally or something you pursue once you sort of become an adult. So when I started school, I was pre-med, and then eventually I just sort of gave in, and I was like, you know what, like, writing English is something that I love to do, and you know, I really want to at least spend, you know, these 4 years doing it. And it was a risk that a lot of people had different opinions on, but I think that the risk paid off, so I'm happy.
Yeah, absolutely. It is a risk, as you were saying, for a number of reasons that we'll get to in a second. When you ended up going for the English major, when you finally committed to this field, how did you feel about it? Were you relieved? Were you scared? Like, oh, I'm in it now. Well, how did you feel?
Oh, I mean, I was definitely terrified, and I was terrified because I think my entire life there's been a very sort of conventional narrative and pretty, like, restrictive narrative of what it means to be successful and what it means to sort of live up to people's expectations of you. And so I was, of course, just scared that I was failing my parents, failing myself, or failing my community, failing my friends, and that if I did do this, like, English major, then eventually I would be homeless, and then, you know, my parents would have immigrated to America for nothing, and all of those dramatics. So I was, of course, very scared, and in that sense, I think choosing to major in English was not just about what am I going to study for the next 4 years, but it sort of represented sort of bigger ideas about, like, what's acceptable to do with your life and what's, like, a worthwhile usage of time. So I was definitely afraid. But I was also happy because it meant that I was prioritizing my own happiness over what other people might say is the correct course of action. And so I was, in a way, I was also, like, proud of myself for having the courage to pursue something that I liked.
And hence the risk that you took to follow this field. How do you feel about that decision retrospectively? At the time, you know, you said you were terrified and afraid of letting down a number of people and your community. How do you feel about this decision retrospectively?
I'm so happy that I did it. Like, if I hadn't decided to, like, pursue English, I probably never would have written. I mean, I would have written for fun, but I don't think would have written the novel that I wrote, and I wouldn't have met the amazing community of, like, writers and professors that I met at Penn. And I think there's, like, a whole side of my intellectual and academic experience that I, like, wouldn't have been able to experience. So I'm really happy in hindsight.
Good. Well, let's just talk about your book, because not only did you take the risk of following this field and following your passion, you're talking about a very intense issue that is not comfortable to, I think, you know, our society. As I mentioned in the introduction, your book dives right into this issue that plagues our communities, and then we don't seem to even have the support needed to talk about mental health in Asian American communities. Let's start maybe with the characters in the story. Introduce them to us.
Sure, yeah, so there are 5 characters, as the title of the novel says. The first is Stella, and Stella is quintessentially depressed in that she's very unhappy and she's angry, but she's also scared that it's going to be like this forever. She's never going to be happy again. We have Andrew, who is struggling with an eating disorder, and of course that's not the only thing going on with Andrew. He's filled with passion. He's actually one of my favorite characters because he's so passionate and he's so sincere and he's so kind, but his eating disorder is sort of taking over his life, and that's something that he has to deal with. Then there's Clarissa, who is an Asian American character who has OCD, and I think a large part of her arc is dealing with the fact that she feels like her mental illness is letting the people who love her down, that, she is never going to experience the things that her mom, for example, wants her to experience. Then there's Ben, who kind of lives inside his own head a little bit more than is healthy. He likes movies more than he likes real life, and he's prone to dissociating from reality and just sort of like experiencing everything from an arm's length. And then finally there's Nathan, who just doesn't really think that he should be there, and he sort of thinks he's better than everyone else, and he's like honestly convinced that all of the people there are just sort of weak and irrational. And so we see, that conflict play out with a character who is forced to be there. He can escape, but he just doesn't think that he has anything to gain from being there, and is very resistant to people's attempts to convince him otherwise.
Right. So those are the characters, and they're, in this group therapy out in the wilderness for 4 weeks together, which can have many different adventures along the way. And as I understand it, as I mentioned in the introduction, you had written this kind of based on your own experiences. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Certainly not every plot point in the novel is like fueled by my own experiences.
Of course.
And it's by no means an autobiographical work. But I think I wrote this novel, or I began this novel at a time coming off of a year where I had experienced some pretty bad depression and anxiety-related issues, and I had gone to a lot of therapy, and I had specifically gone to a lot of group therapy, and coming out of all of that, and it was sort of still very much going on, I started writing the novel very much as I was processing my feelings about my own relationship with mental health, about, settings of therapy, about, communities who come together because of mental illness, and about, the experience of being in group therapy, where everyone is sort of dealing with their own struggle, and you all come together, and it's very difficult at first to see what you have to offer each other, but somehow the setting is oftentimes therapeutic and very effective. And so I was sort of processing my own feelings of fear and sadness and anxiety, processing all of that, and I was spending a lot of time in settings of other people experiencing things who were similar, but also sometimes completely different. And I think a lot of those themes worked their way into the novel through the characters and also through the process of therapy that they go through.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be an autobiographical experience, but just something, some thread from your life that maybe inspired the story. Was it scary to write this story, or what were you feeling throughout the process?
I get asked that quite frequently, actually. I get asked, was it scary? And my answer is always no, because when I was writing it, I really did not think that anyone would ever read it. I was writing it for a class, so I thought, the people in my workshop class will read a couple chapters here and there when it's, my turn to workshop. But other than that, I was pretty certain that this would just sort of live and die on my laptop. And as a result, there wasn't really any fear, because I was just sort of writing what I wanted to write and translating my thoughts and my feelings onto the page. And then I figured no one would ever read it and everything would be fine. So the actual process of writing it was not that scary. However, the publication process, what followed, while, of course, it can come true, was pretty scary, in that it meant sort of shipping out deeply personal work. And all writing is personal, but this was, especially personal for me, to, strangers and people who make evaluative decisions. So that was scary. But the actual drafting process, I think, was that.
Yeah, I can imagine the publication process was frightening. I mean, it would be anyways. And then there's an extra added layer of it. related to that, you know, so for example, the character Clarissa, who is an Asian American girl, as we said, working through obsessive compulsive disorder, OCD, you know, and in the story, what I found interesting, because I talked to a lot of authors, people of color, who I think are on this line based on different trends of what is happening in literature in our communities. I think there are different trends of I'm writing from the Asian American experience. And now it's like, well, just because I'm an Asian American person, I don't have to write from that experience. I can just write. And there is a character who is a person of color and things like that. So what I'm getting to is that with Clarissa, we're talking about her character, her personality, this issue she's dealing with, and her relationship with her mother. And there's nothing in the story that says things like, oh, I'm afraid I might let my community down, or we don't talk about this in our community. And so I was curious, what are your thoughts about that?
I mean, on the subject of Clarissa never sort of saying those things, I think part of it is just that she's very removed. Like, all the characters are pretty isolated, so she's not necessarily thinking about, you know, her community or anything like that. But I think she does think about her mom, and she does think about the expectations that, you know, her mom has for her, and they aren't directly linked. Like, she doesn't directly make a connection to that being related to her being Asian American. I don't think that means that the connection doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. I think it just means that maybe she hasn't realized it yet, or that's not what's on her mind at the moment. I do think what you're saying about in Asian American communities in particular, like, mental health is a topic that's really difficult to discuss and very sort of not frequently discussed. That, I think, is a really salient point, and it's something that, you know, I certainly noticed in my community, and, you know, I've talked to my friends who are Asian American, and they've also noticed in their community, is that, like, as a whole in that community, there's not a lot of dialogue about mental health. And yeah, I've actually said before, it really does feel sometimes the vocabulary is just not there. And it doesn't mean that Asian American parents don't want their kids to be happy. That's obviously not the case. It's just that there's not a tradition of those conversations taking place. And as a result, people find it difficult to have those conversations when they're older. And then they probably find it difficult to have those conversations with their kids. And then it's sort of a feedback loop.
Right, exactly. And that was part of that fear of writing this that I was talking about. Just we're at a very basic level of having these conversations. And on the flip side, you know, even if people go out and find support and help, are the medical professionals in the field equipped to handle this? You know, are they fluent in the issues that afflict the communities? Are they culturally aware, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. Yeah, I think as with sort of any issue like this, the conversation or your own experiences are affected, of course, by every aspect of your identity. And so the most effective conversation for an Asian American woman to have about her experiences of depression or her experiences of an eating disorder are really different from the most effective conversation that a white man might have about his eating disorder. Like, those are just fundamentally different experiences, and so I think there's certainly something to be said for more dialogue from communities where there's traditionally lacking dialogue to start thinking about those things, to start thinking about, like, in our community, what's the most effective way to talk about this? What's, you know, maybe some of the driving factors behind depression in Asian American communities that might be particular to being Asian American, you know? And I think, obviously, I don't have the answer, but those conversations are really important.
Absolutely. I want to move to another topic, a bigger issue of recovery. So after reading this book, I just had some thoughts about the issues that go into this whole experience. We have a pretty expensive camp in the wilderness for this small group of teenagers. So we have to consider there's an economic component, and then there's a cultural component, which we've already been discussing. And of course, you know, the reason for them being there, this treatment component, and all of these issues go hand in hand. So when we're thinking about recovery, you know, for example, I could imagine parents, for better or for worse, I'm not condoning, I'm just imagining that they would say, you know, I just paid $20,000 for this camp. I want to see results in my kid. I want my child back. But on the other hand, it's a 4-week camp. And I don't know, is that a realistic time frame to learn to cope with these issues? And I was just curious about your research and your thoughts on this.
Yeah. So first, I will say, like, the economic component is a huge factor, and I think that's oftentimes overlooked. I've had a lot of conversations with people after writing the book about how race plays into conversations about mental illness, how gender plays into conversations about mental illness, but this is actually, I think, the first time anyone's brought up the economic side, and I think that's so critical, and honestly, a camp like this would definitely be extremely expensive, and you would have to have parents who could afford to send their kids there, and mm-hmm. I think that's true for a lot of aspects of mental health treatment. It's really expensive. Therapy is really expensive. Mm-hmm. Copays can be really high, and so I just want to say thank you for bringing up that side of things, because oftentimes recovery is enabled by having, like, the sort of financial resources to pursue that. Mm-hmm. So that's, I think, a great point that people don't talk about very often. And then to your second point about, you know, it's a four-week camp, does recovery happen in 4 weeks? I mean, I think we all know that the answer to that question is no, right? No one, it was really important to me that I did not write a story where five characters go into, like, mental health camp, and then they come out and they're, like, better or fixed or they've recovered completely. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, that's very not true to life. And I think something that I really struggled with at various points in my life is the pressure to become better or to fix myself or to overcome mental illness was oftentimes as stressful and, like, as debilitating as being depressed. There's a lot of, I'm pretty depressed, which is a struggle in and of itself. And then this idea that I need to become better tomorrow, or I need to go to therapy because then it will make me the person that I used to be. I think there's a lot of pressure that people put on themselves to overcome through willpower or, you know, through internal strength. And it was really important to me that I didn't write a book where characters will themselves into being better, because oftentimes that's really not how the process of recovery works. So I would say, like, at the end of the novel, like, not all of the characters have recovered. I think mm-hmm. some of the characters have moved forward on the path of recovery, which has, you know, forward progress as well as setbacks. Some of the characters have certainly moved forward. I think there are other characters who may not have moved forward as much. And I think that is as much a part of the process of recovery as those moments where you sort of hit your head against the wall and you don't feel like you're making progress. That's as much part of the process of recovery as those, like, hallelujah, come to Jesus moments where, you know, you've had some insight about yourself or your own experiences. So I really wanted to capture both of those things. And I think in some ways that's led to a book that some people find less satisfying at the end, because things aren't all wrapped up. The closure is not perhaps as closed as one might want, but it was just important to me from a principle standpoint and from, like, a lived experience standpoint to tell a story about mental illness where total recovery is not the end of the story.
Yeah, I mean, what are the expectations and what is the process along the way? These are the conversations that nobody has, and I don't know if it's obviously, it's because our society, you know, still has a lot of taboos around mental health, but I don't know if it's also a confidentiality issue or what. Recovery in any sense takes much longer and takes a lot more work than I think the discussion that goes into it, whether it's mental health or a recovery from something physical. There's just so much that we don't discuss. And I appreciated that you had depicted this in that way, that it was a process and that there were conversations and everything wasn't just wrapped up with a neat bow at the end. I actually appreciated that about the book. And especially because this is geared towards a certain age group, I'm really curious, but have you received any responses from the community?
Yeah, I mean, so first of all, thank you for saying that. That's really kind. I'm happy to hear that. I've gotten some lovely, just really moving responses. Like, I have struggled with depression and this is, like, really true to my experience, or this is part of the reason why eating disorders are, like, so hard to overcome or, like, so hard to recover from. And so I've had some people who have been really grateful and they've reached out through Twitter, which is always really surprising. Every time I hear something like that, I really do feel like it is really worth it. Like, I know that's such a cliche sentiment, but it actually does kind of feel like that. You get one person who says, hey, this meant a lot to me, and you're like, okay, I will keep writing.
That's nice to hear. We're just coming to a close here. Is there anything else you wanted to share before we close?
The thing that I'm most happy about this entire book process, which I like never, ever in a million years could happen. The thing that I'm most happy about is that it's allowed me to have conversations with people about mental health, about my culture, about stuff like that, that otherwise I just never would have been able to have. And I think that's the thing that I'm most grateful for, is that this process, writing and publishing this book, has allowed me to have so many conversations that have made me reflect about, you know, my own experiences and the experiences of other people. And I encourage like other people to have those conversations as well with their communities, with people outside of their communities, with their parents, with their friends, if they're depressed, if they see that like one of their friends is going through a really hard time. I'm grateful that my book has enabled me to have those conversations with other people and has enabled people to have those conversations with each other. And I hope that other people feel empowered, not necessarily by my book, but just empowered in general to have those conversations as well.
Jennifer Yu, thanks so much for joining me on Intersections Radio.
Thank you again for having me.
And that was author Jennifer Yu, and her debut novel is 4 Weeks, 5 People. To listen to the podcast of this interview, check out intersectionsradio.wordpress.com, visit the same website for previous episodes of this podcast, and join the Facebook community at facebook.com/intersectionsradio. You are listening to Intersections Radio. I'm Sarika Mehta. Thanks for listening.
And next we go to Between the Lines Radio today, talking about Trump's rationale for pulling out of the Paris Accord. And how that it was based on lies. And we'll get to that in just a moment after this announcement. Thanks for tuning into KBOO today, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio will be broadcasting live from the 25th annual Good in the Hood Multicultural Music and Food Festival. Saturday, June 24th, we'll be on site at Lilis Albina Park and will broadcast the festival from 1:30 to 9:30 p.m.
One more time.
Tune in to hear sets from Surround Sound, No Limits, In Touch, Tamara Stevens, and more. Again, that's a live broadcast from Good in the Hood, Saturday, June 24th, starting at 1:30 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Karen Orenstein, Deputy Director with Friends of the Earth, who examines President Trump's false rationale for pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord and the consequences for the global effort to address the growing threat of climate change. Mark Maurer, Executive Director of the Sentencing Project, who assesses the Trump administration's order to reimpose drug war era harsh sentences in federal drug cases. And Kathy Kennedy, a member of the California Nurses Association National Nurses Organizing Committee Board of Directors, who discusses the campaign to win single-payer health care legislation in California. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Guardian newspaper reports more wealth is extracted from sub-Saharan Africa than is provided to the continent in foreign aid, loans, and African nationals sending remittances home from abroad. Africa is often portrayed as a continent in desperate poverty, in need of urgent aid. Yet Africa has plentiful and valuable natural resources vital to the global digital economy. But a large percentage of these resources are controlled by foreign corporations or corrupt local officials who hide their ill-gotten gains in tax havens. A coalition of British aid and development groups recently released a report titled Honest Accounts 2017, finding that African countries received $162 billion in 2015, mainly in loans, aid, and personal remittances. But in the same year, $203 billion was extracted from the continent, either directly through multinationals repatriating profits and illegally moving money into tax havens, or by the rising costs of climate change adaptation and mitigation. This outflow of vast amounts of money resulted in 47 African nations accruing an annual $41.3 billion deficit, where many people remain trapped in extreme poverty. Aisha Dadwell of the group Global Justice Now declared, "What African countries need is for the rest of the world to stop systematically looting them." In the aftermath of the recent summit of the world's G7 nations in Taormina, Italy, Germany's conservative chancellor, Angela Merkel, was clearly angry at U.S. President Donald Trump when she declared, "We Europeans truly have to take our fate into our own hands." In a message to the strong anti-Trump majority in Germany, Merkel expressed frustration with Trump for refusing to endorse the Paris Climate Accord, which he later officially withdrew from. European leaders were also upset that the reality TV star real estate billionaire refused to endorse NATO's Mutual Defense Pact, which had been activated only once in its history, on behalf of the U.S. after the 2001 9/11 terrorist attacks. After the G7 summit, Merkel and newly elected French President Emmanuel Macron forged a pro-European consensus on climate change, globalization, and open markets. Before tempers cooled, however, Germany's foreign minister Sigmar Gabriel insisted, "Anyone who accelerates climate change by weakening environmental protection, who sells more weapons in conflict zones, and does not want to politically resolve religious conflicts, is putting peace in Europe at risk." Congressional Democrats have introduced a long-awaited piece of legislation to raise the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour by 2024. The bill would eliminate the subminimum wage for tipped workers, such as restaurant servers and taxi drivers. If enacted, axing the subminimum wage would uplift the working poor and put conservatives on the defensive on the issue of wage fairness. Currently, employers pay tipped workers only $2.13 an hour instead of the federal minimum wage of $7.25. There hasn't been a raise in the subminimum wage in 25 years. Moreover, according to the American Prospect, employers of tipped workers often cheat their low-wage employees. 80% of full-service restaurants investigated by the U.S. Department of Labor violated wage and hour laws. As a result, tipped workers suffer from a disproportionately high rate of poverty. If the federal minimum wage is increased to $15 an hour, it's estimated that 40 million workers would receive a raise, mainly benefiting women and people of color. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
President Trump announced on June 1st that he would withdraw the U.S. from the Paris Climate Accord, the global agreement signed by 195 countries in 2015 that set targets for reducing greenhouse gas emissions and limit the increase in global temperatures. During his announcement in the White House Rose Garden, Trump repeated claims, made often during the 2016 election campaign, that the Paris Agreement hurt the U.S. economy by deliberately putting the country at a competitive disadvantage and thereby contributing to unemployment. But analysis of these claims by several prominent news organizations found them to be generally false, relying on dubious statistics supplied by corporations and organizations which aggressively oppose the Paris Accord. Many Fortune 500 companies joined environmental groups, clergy, and the majority of the world's leaders in condemning Trump's decision. There was widespread criticism of Trump for what was judged by many to be a morally reprehensible decision. But many observers also expressed optimism that the global transition to clean energy will continue, with or without the United States government. At least 10 states and dozens of U.S. cities vowed to continue to live up to the commitments made in the Paris Accord, despite President Trump's decision to drop out of the pact. Your reporter spoke with Karen Ornstein, deputy director with Friends of the Earth, who examines Trump's false rationale for pulling out of the accord and the consequences for the global effort to address the growing threat of climate change.
I mean, I watched Donald Trump give the speech, and it was surreal. It was like hearing somebody claim that the sky is neon green when you know the sky is blue. He constructed his own reality, and maybe Stephen Bannon's reality, that somehow the Paris Climate Agreement was a conspiracy by the rest of the world to harm the U.S. in terms of jobs, in terms of economics. And he also created this scenario where, you know, he's number one on tackling the environment, but that's not what the Paris tackling environmental pollution, but that's not what the Paris Agreement does. The Paris Agreement's sole purpose is to hamstring the United States. And so, like, you have this uncle at the table who claims that the world is flat and there's no such thing as gravity. Where do you begin to try to counter the misleading statements, the untruths, the lies? The truth is the Paris Climate Agreement is basically a voluntary agreement among every nation in the world, except a few. Syria, they're not part of it because they're obviously in civil war, and Nicaragua because they thought Paris Agreement was too weak, which I would agree with, it is too weak. Now the United States, and it basically is just the first time that you have every nation on Earth, now minus three, committing to do something, whatever that country determines is in its best interest towards climate change. And there's no sort of sanctions or compliance regime to make sure that what you say you do is actually going to be done. So the U.S. could have, you know, said, well, as part of our climate change commitment, we will, this is what Donald Trump could say, we're going to contribute three red balloons, and that's our climate change commitment. And the rest of the world would have to say okay, because there's nothing binding here. And the reason there's nothing binding is because the whole world watered down their level of ambition in order to cater to the United States, because they knew that any sort of binding treaty would never make it through the Senate, the U.S. Senate. And basically, it was just a way to try to ramp up ambition going forward and to try to have some sort of diplomatic international framework for trying to tackle global climate change. And it was absolutely inadequate, but it was what we had, and we would try to improve on it. And we certainly have lots of criticisms of the climate agreement, but when you have somebody like Trump attacking it and lying about it for all the wrong reasons, it makes you have to sort of defend the minimum you have, which is right now the Paris Climate Agreement.
Karen, I wondered if you'd speak to the possible political consequences here. Is it possible that we might have a movement across the globe that would somehow seek to penalize or sanction the United States and the Trump government for the Paris decision? And I say that with the hope that any kind of boycott or sanctions against the United States would not affect average folks in this country. But it does send a message. We've seen that kind of tactic and strategy used around the world when a country becomes a rogue state, like many believe the United States has become under Trump.
Friends of the Earth and our communications about what Trump is doing, we've called for, you know, governments and people of the world to deploy robust economic and political pressure on the United States to compel us to take meaningful climate action. With things like sanctions, I think we have to be careful that, like you said, we don't hurt ordinary Americans, frontline communities. But I do think there are all sorts of tools in the political and diplomatic toolbox and economic toolbox that can be used to further isolate the United States, because what we are doing is really going to cause death and destruction for hundreds of thousands, if not many millions of people, including here in the U.S. And I think these are early days. But there are people out in the streets everywhere, and I think people are having the conversations that you just brought up. Like, what do we do? Is this the time to, you know, have sanctions like they did in South Africa, or the boycott, divest, sanction movement in Israel-Palestine? Those are all just conversations that are starting to happen. I don't have any of the answers, but I think other countries absolutely have to treat the U.S. as sort of the political pariah that it has become and there has to be consequences.
That was Karen Ornstein, Deputy Director for Economic Policy with Friends of the Earth. Find links to news and analysis on Trump's withdrawal from the Paris Climate Agreement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. News about Donald Trump's recent trip abroad, his decision to pull the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Agreement, and the ongoing investigation into charges that the Trump campaign colluded with Russia to influence the outcome of the U.S. presidential election has dominated the news for the past 2 weeks. But during that time, Trump has launched another major shift away from Obama-era policies that has mostly slipped below the radar. That's the announcement by Attorney General Jeff Sessions of a return to a tough-on-crime policy in federal sentencing guidelines and also on the use of private prisons for federal inmates. Criminal justice reform has been one of the rare areas of bipartisan cooperation in recent years, especially at the state level. Their conservatives and liberals have often been united in an effort to stem the explosive growth in the U.S. prison population that began in the 1980s and is now just beginning to level off and even drop in some cases. The vast majority of the more than 2 million people incarcerated in the U.S. are in state prisons and county jails and won't be affected directly by these changes at the federal level. But the Trump administration is setting a tone that will make it more difficult for politicians to escape the label of soft on crime if they oppose Trump's harsh new measures. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Mark Maurer, executive director of the Sentencing Project, who assesses these policy changes and their likely future repercussions.
Within a week of taking office, the Attorney General reversed an Obama-era decision on the use of private prisons in the federal system. Last summer, the Department of Justice had announced that it was phasing out the use of private prisons at the federal level, basically for two reasons. One, a report by the Office of the Inspector General had found substantial problems of safety and security in the private prisons they were contracting for. And secondly, for a number of reasons, the federal prison population has declined fairly substantially in recent years, so there was less need for them to rely on extra beds from private prisons. With very little evidence or rationale, Attorney General Sessions just overturned that order, said they were very committed to using private prisons, and that would continue under this administration. Attorney General Sessions has reversed a policy put in place by Attorney General Eric Holder that recommended that federal prosecutors use their discretion to avoid imposing a mandatory minimum sentence in cases of low-level drug crimes. The mandatory minimums in the federal system pose what are frequently very harsh 5, 10, 20-year minimum sentences and can be imposed even on relatively low-level players in the drug trade. And Holder, based on much evidence, said this was ineffective, it was overly punitive, and it was wasteful in many ways. Attorney General Sessions has now overturned that and basically has charge his federal prosecutors to seek the highest possible sentence they can prove in every federal case unless there are extreme circumstances that would warrant doing otherwise. So this can only result in increasing numbers of people both going to prison and especially spending more time in prison as a result of this policy initiative. And the Attorney General was not able to point in great detail to any problems of the Holder initiative, but, you know, rather it was a return to the tough-on-crime days of the 1980s and 1990s that are now widely discredited across the political spectrum.
We know the crime rate has fallen pretty precipitously in the last 2.5 decades or so, but now, over the last year or two, it's actually gone up. So, Mark Maurer, how do you respond to that critique that blames the Obama administration for that?
Well, there are some supporters of Attorney General Sessions who make the argument that crime rates, particularly homicide, is going up in recent years, and this is because of Obama administration policies or similar ones at the state level, and therefore we need to implement these tough penalties. And if you look at this issue in context, there's not much there that make that argument. First, crime rates and violent crime as well have declined by nearly half since the early 1990s. There are a number of reasons this has happened, but most American communities are considerably safer today than they were 20 or 25 years ago. It is true that in a handful of cities, Chicago at the top certainly, rates of murder have escalated substantially in the last couple of years, and that should be cause for concern. But there are two issues that really get at the federal system. One, the number of people going through the federal system is only about 13% of the total in terms of number of prisoners in the country. So even with some reduction in recent years, there's no way such a modest portion of the total could have a substantial impact on any given city. Secondly, what we know about crime rates and violent crime is that much of this is driven by local conditions. If there were truly a problem of people coming out of prison committing crime, we should be seeing dramatically rising rates of murder all across the country, and that's certainly not what we're seeing. So we do know that local conditions, which may include the presence of gangs, it may involve type of policing that's going on, it may involve the availability of illegal weapons, particularly for teenagers. All of these factors can drive short-term spikes in crime in different places. So we need to address those local conditions, but doing a sort of one-size-fits-all federal approach, emphasizing harsh sentencing, is not getting at all at those underlying conditions.
That was Mark Maurer, Executive Director of the Sentencing Project. Find more analysis and commentary on the Trump administration's criminal justice policies by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As President Trump and the Republican-controlled Congress push to repeal Obamacare and institute a new health care system that would cause an estimated 23 million people to lose their health insurance coverage, the nation's largest state is moving in the opposite direction. Proposed legislation, SB 562, known as the Healthy California Act, would establish a universal single-payer health insurance system that would provide coverage for all of California's 39 million citizens without any out-of-pocket costs. The measure, led by Democratic California State Senator Ricardo Lara, won Senate passage on June 1st by a vote of 23-14. The legislation now goes to California's State Assembly, where details about the financing of the proposed new healthcare system must be fleshed out. While Republican opponents of the bill say the state can't afford such an ambitious plan, the California Nurses Association, which supports the bill, produced a study that finds raising the state's sales and business receipts taxes by 2.3% would raise $106 billion of the annual cost, with the balance coming from state and federal funding, already going to Medicare and Medicaid services. Your reporter spoke with Kathy Kennedy, a registered nurse, and a member of the California Nurses Association National Nurses Organizing Committee Board of Directors. Here she discusses the campaign to win single-payer health care in California, the coalition supporting the bill, and the challenges ahead for final passage of the legislation.
Senate Bill 562, which is the Healthy California Act, essentially says this, is that it guarantees health care as a human right for all Californians, residents of California, and it provides real health security for all of our residents, which is a comprehensive benefit, which means that you have complete choice of providers and there's no out-of-pocket costs. So when we talk about, you know, comprehensive benefits, we're talking about, you know, there's not going to be any co-pays, there's not going to be any more deductibles, and that comprehensive benefit includes in- and outpatient care. It also includes dental. I think a lot of times people think that, you know, dental care is not part of health care, but it is. Vision, prescription drugs, rehabilitation, immunizations, all those things that people struggle every day. You know, here in California, we have those that are insured, and then we have some that are underinsured. And so a lot of people, you know, they, you know, with the ACA, we had more Californians that were covered under the Affordable Care Act, but because the co-pays and the deductibles were so high, a lot of patients couldn't afford to use their insurance. SB 562, that would totally eliminate that. So there would no longer be the need to have any co-pays or out-of-pocket costs.
Kathy, what's the next step in the legislative process to move this idea of universal health care forward for the state of California?
As you know, we got it through the Senate, so now we are going to, you know, this bill is being brought to the Assembly. So we need to push our Assembly members to pass this particular bill. And we know that there's going to be some discussion about the financial study and such. And then once it gets through the Assembly, then it has to go back to the Senate. Again, I believe it's a two-thirds vote, both at the Assembly and then again at the Senate. And then it will go to the governor's desk. So we have a lot of work ahead of us, but I'm telling you, in California, we have so many organizations that are behind this bill. It's amazing. I've gone to several town hall meetings in Northern California, and people are excited. They really think that it is time. People are tired of insurance company profiting off of healthcare, and that's just not something that should happen. So people are really ready to get out and, you know, do the hard work and make this happen.
What about Governor Jerry Brown, a fairly progressive politician over many decades? What's his view of this single-payer system being proposed in California?
Well, you know what? I don't, you know, personally, you know, I wonder too, because I think for years our governor has always talked about, you know, having a single payer system, and right now he's not quite sure, and he wanted to see the financial study. So we presented, you know, we have it now, and my hope, CNA's hope, National Nurses United hope, is that, you know, once the bill gets to his desk, that he would sign it, because we have clearly shown through the financial study that this is possible, and it and families will have savings and businesses will have savings. So I think that we just need to convince Governor Brown that this is possible, and, you know, we have the proof, so we just have to push.
You know, one of the things that I think we can look to is that when the nation of Canada adopted their system of universal single-payer health care, it happened first in one of their provinces, in Saskatchewan. And the system worked so well there in Saskatchewan that it was adopted federally by the whole nation of Canada. Is mm-hmm. that something that in your dream of dreams you're hoping would happen if the roads were blocked for single-payer at the federal level, that an example set in California really could open up a lot of minds and a great example of how the single-payer system would work well in one state and thereby the entire country?
Yes, absolutely. You know, and as you know, California is one of the six largest economic systems, you know, as far as just the state alone. because a lot of things, as you know, happen in California, and then we really want to lead the way. And so that is the reason why we are pushing so hard, along with all of our other colleagues, all the other organizations. It is a coalition, and we are working together, and we are determined to make this happen in the state of California.
That was Kathy Kennedy, a registered nurse and member of the California Nurses Association National Nurses Organizing Committee Board of Directors. For more information on the Healthy California Act single-payer healthcare plan proposal, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WESU in Middletown, Connecticut, KGNU in Boulder, Colorado, KYRS in Spokane, Washington, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
A little Sivuca, taking us almost to the top of the hour. It's about 9:58, and you're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, and then at 11 o'clock, the Dirtbag answers your gardening questions. And once again, we thank you, KBOO members, for generous support. And if you would like to join our membership our membership roles, please go to kbu.fm and click on donate, and you can become one of us. Thanks for doing that. And we're going to listen to a couple of announcements before we go to Flashpoints. Thank you for tuning into KBOO this morning.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Open Source Bridge Conference, June 20th to 23rd at the Elliott Center in Portland. Open Source Bridge is a conference for developers working with open source technologies and for people interested in learning the open source way. The conference has five tracks connecting people across projects, languages, and backgrounds to explore open source. Again, that's the Open Source Bridge Conference, June 20th to 23rd at the Elliott Center, 1226 Southwest Salmon Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the 25th annual Good in the Hood Multicultural Music and Food Festival, June 23rd through June 25th at Lil's Albina Park in Portland. The Good in the Hood Music and Food Festival is the largest multicultural festival in the Pacific Northwest. This three-day music festival opens up with a community parade that travels through Northeast Portland and ends at Lil's Albina Park. The parade starts at 11 a.m. from King Elementary School on Saturday, June 24th, and ends at Lil's Albina Park, where there will be music, food, and resources while connecting people with experiences that strengthen unity in community. Again, that's the 25th Annual Good in the Hood Multicultural Music and Food Festival, June 23rd through June 25th at Lil's Albina Park at North Flint Street and Russell Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Portland.
Today on Flashpoints, we take a look at the nearly 16-year U.S. military invasion and occupation of Afghanistan. Following an admission by Defense Secretary Jim Mattis today, the United States is not winning the war there. Then we dig deeper into the so-called Russiagate scandal amid continuing allegations of election tampering by the Democrats.